Now, the fall season, lots going on. If you live up in the Salmon Arm area, it's when the salmon are just arriving, all decrepit and falling apart and ready for that last moment of life. And it's a tremendous journey, and it's kind of like the Christian's journey of life, where you swim upstream and you fight and you claw, and then eventually you die. And it's we're just here to just lift you up this Sunday morning. We as Christians, we have a life that is one where we don't just coast into glory. We are called to run and to fight the good fight and to crawl, and we fight against the current of our sinful nature. We fight against the current of our culture at times, and we've been looking at these seven words to change your life, and today it is the word enough, which is a powerful one if we believe it, if we live by it. But the word and the idea of enough, man, like I have enough, it's not so easy to live by, because when it comes to possessions, we've got this constant outward conditioning that says you need more. We've got the inward inclination that says the same thing. We're not inclined to think, you know, I've got enough and be satisfied. When it comes to the busyness of our calendars, it's so easy not to just look to do enough to please God. We also, you know, burn it at both ends and overextend ourselves to make sure we're pleasing people as well. And when we've had enough, when we're fed up with something, we so often struggle to know how to productively move forward from that point. And so we're going to be looking at these three times when saying enough can be really transformative to us. And so the first, it's going to be up on the screen if you want to take notes, is I have and will have enough. We'll jump right into it. We are bombarded with the opposite message, of course, right? You don't have enough. You haven't accomplished enough. You're not pretty enough, smart enough, thin enough. Don't have enough on the go. But thankfully, the industries out there have the solutions for us. You know, they've got the solutions. We'll pay the first 3 months of your lease and then defer payments for a year, and then you just pay us every year for the rest of your life, and your problems will be solved. And if you just eat this special little thing, then you'll be beautiful enough to be confident. And if you would just come to our school, you'll be intelligent enough to make, you know, all that money that you dreamed of. And there's the perpetual fine print, which is always said really quickly, you know, that this narrative is perpetual. We actually don't promise that you will feel enough or that you have enough, you know, when using our product. They actually hope you don't, because the next model is just around the bend. And there's so many reasons why we might be led to believe we don't have enough and start to live by like a scarcity mentality, and we begin to hoard. And one of those, aside from kind of the cultural and status side of things, is just a fear of not having enough in the future. And I think a perfect example is this guy. This is a picture of Dave Nessia. On the one hand, he's Healthy Dave. On the other hand, on the other picture, he's known as Starving Dave. And he's from the TV show Alone, where you get dropped off in the wilderness, my dream. And you get dropped off, you survive for as long as you can. You don't know the other people if they're doing good or if they're all out except for one. You have no idea. So you have to plan to just live as long as you can. And Dave, he started out Healthy Dave. He was fit. He was a survival guide. He knew his stuff. When he got to Patagonia, he began to catch fish. He found out how to catch fish. So he could smoke them and he could store them. But he started to live with this scarcity mentality because he didn't know how long he was going to catch fish. And so he stored them up and he rationed. And rationing is very good when you're in a situation like that. But he was doing it to the extreme where he was eating like every other day. And so his body is slowly starting to turn on itself, and he loses 10 pounds and 20 pounds and 30 pounds and 42 pounds eventually. And, I mean, he didn't start out as a really big guy. So 42 pounds in, the medical team comes and says, your body's starting to shut down. Your body has turned on itself. You're in starvation mode psychologically. You're not able to make decisions anymore. And so they pulled him from it, even though he had a ton of fish left. He could have eaten and been healthy. He could have eaten every single day, but he didn't, because he got into this scarcity mentality, and this starvation was so powerful, it had convinced him he had to ration so sparingly that it was killing him. And as I say, I think we touch a lot on the cultural side. We want to look well off. We don't think I have enough, because we want to have more, and there's this intoxicating feeling of peeling that blue plastic off the stainless steel, and it's just this cycle that we want to be engaged on. But I think we touch on that quite often, and so I want to go from that other direction, that you should be encouraged to say, I have enough, and I will have enough on the grounds, on the basis that God knows your needs and will provide for them. On that alone, I'm not going to come down on you know, RRSPs and RESPs and stuff like that, because wise planning and stewarding resources, that's good stuff. It's foolish to have no concept of tomorrow and just be frivolous today. But when we're motivated by fear of not having enough in the future, we can become greedy today. And we can get that scarcity mindset, the mindset of a hoarder. And instead of saying, I have enough and I will have enough because God knows my needs and will provide for me, we start to act like that's our responsibility. And so like chipmunks, we just fill our cheeks till they're exploding and then go and hide the nuts and come back and go and get more and go and hide them all over the place. And that becomes life. We work to get more so we can stash it safely. And then that's it. We just keep stashing and stashing and stashing. And then eventually, the chipmunk dies and there's a bunch of nuts that don't end up being any benefit to him or his offspring or his chipmunk buddies when they want a snack. I don't know, it's no benefit to anybody. It's great that a tree grows, but for the most part, there's a workaholic mentality that's just, I've got to have more, I've got to have more, I've got to have more. And there's some wisdom in that, but it can extend into something that is detrimental. And I mean, there is the opposite side of things where we can save up enough and then put our complete hope in that. We've got our hope in our wealth, we've got our hope in the bank account, everything's set, and so we kick back and we eat, drink, and be merry and are not conscious of what it means to be generous anymore. But there is this huge difference between preparing for the future and living today by hoarding and by being greedy and saving up more than what you need. And Jesus told the story of a rich man. It's in Luke chapter 12. He just calls this man a fool for saving up all of his goods. And if you have a Bible, I encourage you to take it out. If you don't bring a Bible to church, I would say bring one. It's great to have it on the screen. I have it so that it's easy and convenient. But at the same time, for you to be able to navigate your own scripture, to have that connection that this is in your pocket all the time. We don't just see it here. It's on your nightstand. It's available anytime. It's a great habit to get into. So by all means, if you have a device or a Bible, bring it out. Luke chapter 12, this is the story that Jesus told. Jesus said to the people, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." And then he told them this parable. "The ground of a certain man, a rich man, yielded an abundant harvest. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns, I'll build bigger ones, and then I'll store my surplus of grain. And I'll say to myself, you've got plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you've prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God." And when looking at the future, we can so easily say, "I will store it up so that I can provide for my needs." And in this story, this man, he failed to be generous to God and others in the meantime, as he made plans for the future, but then was not generous to others, and that's the error. And we can't miss that it's not planning that's wrong, it's not savings that's wrong, it's hoarding while failing to be obedient and generous as God calls us to be today. That's where the sin and the error lies. The sin is not working hard and planning wisely and having a future in mind. The failure is in being rich, but in failing to be rich towards God and others and recognizing that it's from Him that all these blessings came in the first place. And this richness towards God will be one that is expressed in so many ways. Of course, one of the most obvious is given to the church. Might I say it's a very important one, of course. But there's other ways to be generous to God. You're generous to God when you support missionaries and give to charitable organizations and support those who are in need. When you take a homeless person out for lunch, or you give to organizations that help the downtrodden and under-resourced. When you bring 300 pounds of food next week, that's a good goal. How about you bring 300 pounds? That's your own personal goal. Bring 300 pounds. That's generosity towards God, because we're told again and again that when we care for those and are generous towards those God loves, that's counted as generosity towards Him. It's counted as giving towards Him. We see it when Jesus talks about how when the hungry are fed and the thirsty are given something to drink, He says, it's like you've done it for me. And that idea was written by Solomon in the Proverbs hundreds of years before when it's written, "Whoever's kind to the poor lends to the Lord." It's one and the same. If you're kind to the poor, it's as if you're lending to the Lord, and the Lord will reward you for what you've done. And so we're encouraged in scriptures, absolutely, count the cost, be mindful of the future, go ahead and plan it, but don't be so concerned with the needs that might come up tomorrow that you fail to be obedient to God today. Because today is the day when God calls you to be generous. Today is the day when God calls you to meet the needs of others, and we don't know if tonight is the night that our life will be demanded from us. And today is the day when we're called to be supportive of the mission of the gospel going out in the world and looking out to the interests of others and being selfless and being generous. And for us to be secure enough to give away today some of what could be stored up as a safety net for us in the future, we have to have the faith that God knows our needs and will provide for them. That's how we can give away with freedom, is by having faith that God knows what we'll need tomorrow and will provide for us. Now, that provision may come through our own savings and the gift that we maybe have had to have surplus through our life and to wisely save, but you might have made every effort to have a nest egg, and circumstances beyond your control make it so that it just hasn't been possible. Just the market crashed and there's nothing you can do about it. But regardless, whether you've got a huge savings account and RRSPs coming down the pipe, or whether you've got nothing and you're not sure what retirement's going to look like for you, in both cases, God knows your needs and will provide for you. That's his promise. That's Jesus' promises. I'm not drawing that out of some kind of random passage and jumping to it. This is his promise. He says, if the birds of the air have something to eat, and if the lilies of the field are clothed in splendor the way that they are, if things like birds and flowers are not overlooked, don't you think that you who are made in the image of God, beloved by him, adopted into his family, he's not going to forget about you and keep feeding the sparrows and give them something to eat while you starve. He is going to meet your needs. We're called in today to have faith and believe that we have enough and we will have enough, so much so that we can be obedient to what God leads us to day in and day out. And we got to know that obedience today will not lead us to being in want tomorrow. By being generous today, you're not going to be without tomorrow. Your obedience today is walking in the path that God has for you into a future where you'll always have enough. And I can speak experience-wise, as you grow up, some people get to a place where there's just plenty of money. It's not something you have to worry about, although certainly most people who have lots of money still find that it's something that they worry about. But there's something freeing about being generous today, mindful of the future, but aware of what God's calling you to and obedient to it day to day. And I had heard a long time ago, if you want to know somebody's priorities, you look at their bank statement, and I found it convicting. I don't think it's an ironclad statement, but, you know, kind of the idea is talk's cheap. You can say you value some things, but what you spend your money on is what you really value. Like I said, it's not ironclad, but I found it convicting because in seasons of life where I've failed to give to God, and these have come and gone for a whole bunch of reasons, and maybe you can identify. Sometimes it's just forgetfulness. It's unbelievable how easy it is to forget to bring a check to church, like week after week, month after month. Other times I've just decided, you know, I just don't have enough right now. I just can't spare it, and so I've just decided not to. Other times I just have a fear that, you know, if I give now, I'm just not going to have enough. There's a number of reasons where I've kind of failed to give, but I tell you what I haven't failed to do is pay my Netflix subscription, and I haven't failed to be able to pick up Starbucks coffee when I felt like it, and I haven't failed to meet a friend for wings if I get invited. And so maybe it's not totally fair to say, you know, if you look at somebody's bank statement and they didn't drop cash in the box on the way out on a Sunday, which wouldn't show up on a bank statement anyway, but if you give online, which is an option at redemptioncommunitychurch.ca/giving, it would show up on your bank statement. But if that doesn't show up, it's not necessarily that you're so wicked, but I think in these seasons of life where I have said I don't have enough to give to God, I've been able still to pay my mortgage and put gas in my car and pay the MSP for my kids, I pay the league fee for hockey, I pay for the gym membership I don't use, I pay 1,000 times more than is necessary for a cup of coffee as long as it's got a creepy green lady on the cup. And then there's the line below which the things I didn't feel like I could afford, which were like giving to the church and supporting missionaries and treating my friends when I go out with them and taking a homeless person out for lunch. And when I look at it that way, I think that doesn't sit right with me. It's crazy that my priorities can be expressed in that way. And so it's my personal experience, and maybe you found similar, that when I give first, I enjoy the rest of what I have more. I sense the blessing that the unnecessary pleasures of life that we get to enjoy here, day in and day out, I sense the blessing and the gift that they are all the more when I realize how unnecessary they are, and yet we still get to enjoy them. And so this idea that I have and I will have enough is a perspective that if we grab hold of it and we live by it, it's transformative today and in our future, and it makes us able to give generously and make an impact in the world around us that is, you know, kind of unprecedented when we think my money is off the table. I can't give any of that away. Another time when saying enough is extremely countercultural is by simply saying, I am busy enough. And in a time, we mentioned it at prayer on Friday morning, we talk about busyness as a badge of honor. And we so easily link our worth to our accomplishments and to what others think of us. And so the idea of saying, no, I'm busy enough already, when a new opportunity comes along or somebody asks us something or invites us to something, it's so hard to do. And I don't know when it happened. I wasn't alive more than like 33 years ago. But at some point in history here, I think it became normal that you have to have an excuse to not respond and go out with somebody to do something that they ask you to do. Like, you can't just say no. And you have to have an excuse. You have to have a good excuse. And there's acceptable excuses and not acceptable excuses. You can say you're sick, but you have to prove it by being sick next time you see them as well. You can't just sound sick on the phone, because we all know that you're not going to talk on the phone. And so that's clear. So if you're going to say you're sick, you have to prove you're sick the next time you come. You can have prearranged plans, but you can't just say, sorry, I've got plans. You have to say what they are, and they have to trump what you're being invited to. There's a feeling like you've really got to prove that you've got something else going on. And if you're out of town, that's even better. That's ironclad, unless they drop on you like, oh, I was asking about next Friday. No, now I have to help or come and do something. These are kind of some of the acceptable excuses that are out there. And it's crazy that we have to act that way. And then some of the ones that we don't feel okay saying, excuses for not taking on new commitments or somehow being involved in another event that would be totally legitimate, are things like, I'm going to rest. Period. I mean, we can say, I need to rest if I'm getting up at 3:30 in the morning. Okay, then it's convincing. But you can't just say, I'm tired. I need to recharge a little bit. That's somehow not really acceptable. To say, I'm going to spend time with my family. I don't know how this did not become a sufficient excuse, but I tell you, I sometimes feel guilty just simply saying, I'm going to spend time at home tonight with my wife and kids. And I don't know when that became not a good enough reason, but, and I mean, I don't think anybody's out there thinking like, you're going to spend time with your kids? You live with them. You're always with them. It's so lame. Nobody's thinking that, and yet maybe, I don't think I'm the only one who feels like that's maybe not a good enough excuse. But it hit me like a ton of bricks. I shared it on Friday morning. We have a prayer meeting that happens. And I said, you know, last week it was so great. We had a special day at home. Dad was going to be at home. It was a special day. My wife was there. I was there. My kids were there. We planned it out. What are we going to do? Dad doesn't have to work. Dad doesn't have to go out. Dad doesn't have to fix anything. It is so special. So we planned it all out and we enjoyed it. And it's only in hindsight that I realize how wrong it is that Dad being home was special and not normal. And it hit me like nothing else. It should be normal that I'm at home to put my kids to bed. It should be less common that I'm out away from them. And I know that sometimes you gotta work multiple jobs and double end shifts and work night shifts. And so I'm not saying it's a crime that you're not home when your kids go to bed or anything like that. What I'm saying is it's so easy to just not have a cap on our busyness where we say, I'm busy enough and I can't take that on. And so incoming is this commitment to work and hobbies and projects and side hustles and friends and sports, and all of a sudden we neglect the things that we would otherwise say are the most important in our marriage and our families and our relationship with God and our commitment to serving Him and the church and these sorts of things, and we don't even realize we've done it. All of a sudden it's special when you're with your family, and that's not the way it's supposed to be. And I confess, this is one where I've got a long way to go, and I've said it before, and I invite you, my life is an open book. When you see me being too busy, you call me on it. It's not a good thing, because I look at the scriptures and it always rubs me the wrong way, because resting is something that made the top 10 of God's commands to the Israelites, and it's so easy to just not even justify, oh, I don't have time for that. just not do it, just flat out pretend it doesn't exist. But there it is, plain as day in Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days, labor, do all your work. The seventh day is Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it, you shouldn't do any work. You, your son or daughter, male or female servant, your animals, nor any foreigner working among you. Like, no, nobody. Get it? There's no kind of ifs, ands, or buts about this. There is a time for rest. For in 6 days, God made the heavens and the earth and everything in them. He rested on the seventh, and the Lord blessed it and said, this is a holy day. And it's so difficult to say, I'm busy enough, and I need time to rest. I need time to Sabbath. I need time to be with God. I need time to invest in my family. So no, I'm not going to do that good thing that I would like to do. It's so hard, and yet Jesus reminds us, this isn't supposed to be burdensome, this command. The religious leaders, the Pharisees, they made it burdensome. But originally, it wasn't supposed to be. It's for us. And so Jesus and his friends are walking through the grain fields, and they're picking heads of grain, and the Pharisees are always trying to trap him being a bad Jewish person, a bad Jewish leader, and they say, you're harvesting. Come on, like I picked a head of grain, but no, you're harvesting, you're a sinner, you don't even care about the law. But this is the law, not as God intended it when he said don't work on the Sabbath. And so Jesus clarified that he is the Lord of the Sabbath, and he said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In other words, this is created for you, people. It's intended to help you. You need it. God didn't need to rest after he created, but you need to rest after every 6 days of work. And it was to help people, not burden them. The people in Egypt, they'd come out of slavery before they got the Ten Commandments, where they had worked every day at the end of a whip, mercilessly. Now they're not in slavery anymore. And God says, with that freedom, choose to rest. Over productivity, over profits, choose to rest. And the religious leaders had piled onto it so much detail that you couldn't help your animal that fell into a well. You couldn't pick a head of grain while you were walking through the fields because that was harvesting and that was working. So you just had to sit there that whole day. Of course it's miserable. Nobody wants to do that because you're going to get accused of working if you do anything, if you walk more than a mile or whatever it was that they had put on top of this. It wasn't supposed to be a burden, and it's not supposed to be a burden to us. But it takes a lot of discipline. And it doesn't mean we just have to sit still for that 24 hours once a week because we will go mental. That's not going to help anything. But rest can be accomplished in so many different ways through activities which are restorative, recreation, to be recreated and restored through what you do. Point is, so much of what we fill our lives and our days with doesn't contribute to obeying this command, doesn't contribute to us benefiting from it the way that God intended. And it's not natural for us to say, you know what, I'm busy enough. I can't take on more. But it transforms our lives when not only do we say, I'm busy enough, but when we recognize I'm too busy and I need to dial it back. And I think the journey to this, at least in my experience as I'm taking baby steps towards it, is to stop and think about the allocation of time, to think about my life the way it is and realize there are some things that are important and there are some things that aren't, and there are some things that other people want me to think that are important because they're important to them, which I need to decide are not important enough to me to get my time, because God has called me to a different set of priorities than somebody else. And that's hard, but we can practice saying no without an excuse. And I mean, it's so cold to end a text message with just a period. I've never done it. I'm too scared that somebody's gonna be mad at me if I just say, I hope you have a good night, period. I look at my phone and it's like the last message that I've sent is like thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up, thumbs up. I can't just end it with a period. But maybe I should just be able to say, I'm not able to do that, period. Please don't hate me, but let's practice doing that. And when we're on the receiving end, when somebody says, you know what, I'm not able to, we could just say, have a great night. Or, all right, I'll see you soon. Instead of, why, what are you doing? It's like, we're feeding this. Why don't we stop that cycle that we have to make these excuses and trust that we're not going to do this and set up boundaries that are just giving us more opportunity to be sloths. That's not the point. But recognizing that spending time with God and spending time serving him and spending time with your family and investing in relationship, that's good reason enough, not even an excuse, that's good reason enough to not take on another commitment and burden ourselves, because it's essential for our spiritual and relational health. So like I say, I mean, recognize also there's a difference between just saying no to everything that would be profitable so that you can spend more time playing video games. I look at binging Netflix and, I mean, just let's look at our priorities, realize I'm not saying TV is a complete waste of life, it's just mostly a waste of life. And it doesn't necessarily add value, but I will admit that I like watching a Blue Jays game once in a while. 2 years ago, I liked watching a Blue Jays game once in a while. So I'm not saying like smash your TV and open a soup kitchen, but just recognize as the hours go on that every hour you spend doing something is an hour you're spending not doing a million other things. And that doesn't mean you can't watch TV or you can't golf or you can't do something that you enjoy. But when you do that, you're choosing not to do some other things. And those other things might be helping a friend with something they have going on, or caring for someone who's poor, or spending time reading or praying. And so often with these things, we say, I just don't have time for it. But we found time for other things, just like we find money for other things. And it's just a matter of kind of sorting out our priorities and saying, sometimes I've got enough on the go, and what I actually need to do is dial back some things that I really don't consider top priorities that are getting the lion's share of my time. It's not saying we have to eliminate all things. A couple of weeks ago, if you were here, all seashell collecting. It doesn't mean you have to get rid of everything that isn't eternally profitable, because it may be useful for you in rest and an ability for you to be restored on a week-to-week basis. But it might be time to make some adjustments and not just saying, okay, well, I'm not giving enough and serving enough, and so I'll just add that to my list. Well, then you're going to go Mach 3, you're going to burn relationships, you're going to have spiritual detriment, because that's where uninterrupted, incessant busyness leads, is just the breakdown of relationships and a relationship with God. So find a way to say, I'm busy enough, and build it around some priorities and boundaries that are godly and that serve Him. The last one is saying, I've had enough. And we started with saying, I have and will have enough. This isn't reflective, I've had enough because God has provided for me. This is, I'm fed up. I've had enough. This is a powerful thing to be able to say, because it's good at times to get to a tipping point, if it's a tipping point over something that matters, and if it's a tipping point into godliness or restoration or something that is healthy. To reach a tipping point that leads to positive transformation can be a really important thing. It can change your life to say, I've had enough of this addiction. I realize that I'm powerless against it and that I need help before it costs me everything. It's powerful, and this is where the book of Colossians is so on the money. And I remember when we had our services at night, like all five of us over at Parkland there, so glad that we moved to the morning. Thank you for coming this morning. Those were lean days, and maybe there was 10. But there was a time I preached through Colossians, and in Colossians chapter 3, I had a message called Behind the Barn. And it was about taking your sin out behind the proverbial barn and putting it down. Because this is what we're called to do in the scriptures, to not entertain the sinful habits that we have in life that destroy us, to not let them live in our house anymore, to deal with them. It says in Colossians 3, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, greed, which is idolatry. It can transform your life when you have a moment where you say, I've had enough of this sin, and you're motivated enough to make a change. And the way that you go behind the barn with your sin can look a lot different depending on what sin it is. It's not always that you take your computer and you smash it, but maybe that's exactly what it is. Sometimes it means inviting somebody else to go with you, because maybe your experience is that you've taken that sin out behind the barn and you've put it to bed, you've killed it, and then you left it, and then it came slithering back because you can't seem to kill it on your own. So you're going to invite someone to know what you're taking behind the barn, to know what sin you're trying to put down, to help you with that, and to help make sure that is dead and buried and stays buried. Maybe having enough of your sin and being sick of it carrying on in your life means inviting somebody else into it. Maybe it means enrolling in treatment or counseling and saying, I can't get over this myself. There's no shame in that. There is an industry out there of people who understand the mind in a way that is so much beyond the average person and can help you understand why you feel what you feel, why you do what you do. And treatment and counseling can be a powerful thing when you've said, I've had enough, and you take that angst and you put it into action. And it might mean getting rid of some things that tempt you and show you that you're serious about purity. It's an important thing to be able to say, I've had enough, and then do something about it. And if you have no idea what to do, then ask somebody you trust who loves Jesus and would want to see you find freedom in Christ, what do I do? Because I've tried everything else and I know it's going to destroy me. Or it is destroying my relationship with God, or it is already eating away at my marriage, or whatever it might be. It's another life-changing time is to say, I've had enough of this relationship being like this. And of course, it can apply to friends and family. Marriage is a huge one where this can be an important moment to say, I've had enough of this relationship being like this. And I'm not saying announcing, I've had enough, I'm out, I'm packing my bags. But recognizing the path to restoration can begin when you've had enough of it and you say it. And you say, I've had enough of the lying or the cheating or the laziness or the anger in this house, and communicating it with restoration in mind, not with resentment in mind, not with bitterness as the driver, not with revenge and desiring to inflict pain as the main motive, but a loving but clear communication of what has caused pain and what you hope will happen as a result of you sharing it. We always make fun of guys not knowing anything, not having a clue about anything. I think it goes both ways in this kind of thing where you can say what has hurt you, but if you don't help paint a picture of what you hope will change, what you hope will happen by sharing that, you might not be making any steps towards productivity because I might just find out that I'm a jerk. That's not a huge surprise, and I don't know what you want me to do with that. That's the way I am. And how often do we just say, well, that's the way I am. Take it or leave it. When we communicate what we hope would happen because of our sharing pain, not by way of ultimatums, not by way of saying you are 100% wrong and you need to change or else, but in saying I've had enough, it doesn't mean necessarily that I've had enough of you and you need to change and it needs to happen by this day or else it's over. You could very well mean I've had enough of this stalemate, of this lack of communication. I've had enough of us not talking about the fight that we had that we never talked about last week or last month or last decade. You can say, I've had enough of the fighting and we've talked about it, but we can't get past it. I have no idea what to do. I've had enough and I think we need help. It's a powerful thing. And when we fail to express it, when we keep in how we're hurting, we can so easily build up resentment and distance ourselves to protect ourselves and not move closer towards the restoration of a relationship and the actual ownership of having hurt one another. And things don't get better in that. And so many marriages end because there's an unwillingness on the part of one to listen to their spouse saying and reaching that boiling point, that tipping point. There's also breakdown when somebody is unwilling to say it, because they assume it's not going to matter anyway. And so many marriages maybe just manage to get along but hardly find passion and excitement that is supposed to characterize this most beautiful relationship above any other. And so when we think, how do we say I've had enough seriously but not driven by anger and bitterness, we can only say it's with God's help. It's only by looking at Jesus and the way we've been treated by him and the grace we've been treated with that we don't deserve. That's the only way we can start to say, I've had enough, in a productive way. In that same chapter in Colossians, where Paul writes to put to death your sinful nature, he also says that as God's chosen people, we should act differently than we used to act. And this is how, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and patience, and bear with each other and forgive one another. If any one of you has grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. How's that for an example to follow, an act to follow? And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them together in perfect unity. And it is hard when we feel broken inside by the person that we've trusted the most. And only when we look to Jesus and we see that he had compassion for others when they didn't deserve it, and he showed humility before others when he had every right to be proud, and he had patience in dealing with mistake-making, imperfect people. It's when we learn to forgive because we've been forgiven, as we've been forgiven, when we see that we're not being asked to muster this up on our own, but only to pass on the grace and love that we've been given, to receive it and be drenched in it, to revel in it, to have it overflow out of us. That's when we can do this. And so it's not just about saying, today's the day where I'm going to go and tell my spouse I've had enough because my pastor told me to. Invest in your relationship with the Lord so that you're overflowing with the compassion and the humility and the patience of Christ when you approach someone and say, I've had enough and I want it to change. I believe there's more for us than this. When we say I've had enough with grace and love, it can be the starting point in a journey towards restoration and healing. And this range of ways in which we can use this word are powerful. It's to recognize we've got enough and we'll have enough, that we've got more than enough on the go to the detriment often of what's most important, and that our lives can be transformed by saying I've had enough and taking positive steps towards restoration in his strength and following his lead. These things can be so powerful, and God is good and he will be with you as you learn to say enough in these ways. And so pray with me. Father, I pray that you would help us see that your grace is sufficient for us, that it is enough for us, that you are more than enough. I pray that you help us see that you promise to meet our needs and that you're good and that you're rich and that you own everything and have no shortage of supply to give to us. Pray that you help us see that you command us to rest and that we have to learn to say at some point we're busy enough before we've used up every second of every day, because there needs to be that margin, that breathing room, not just because it's good for us, but also because you've commanded it of us. And we shouldn't just ignore things that are important to you because it's not culturally normal for us to embrace them. That's reason all the more to set a new standard, to swim against the current and to show a different way of life, life that is true life, life that isn't exhausting, but that is abundant and full. God, help us know that your promise to forgive us when we confess our sins to you is sure, and that you will strengthen us to walk in freedom as we say we've had enough of our sin. We pray with thanksgiving for your faithfulness, and we offer you our obedience and our love and our worship, for you are worthy, you are enough. And should all else in life be lost, may we be faithful in declaring that you, Jesus, are enough. We pray these things in Jesus' name. And as we stand and worship, there is someone from the prayer team down here. If you'd like to have prayer for anything that you're facing, that you're experiencing, that you want to know how to apply, put these things into practice, Steph would be pleased to pray with you in these moments during these songs. Why don't we stand and sing?